Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In a few years, we'll have to find a whole new language for race. No more minority scholarships, no minority rights groups, no minority leaders. That's because whites will no longer be the majority.
Virtually every white supremacist in America has the year 2050 very much imprinted on his or her brain. The Census Bureau has predicted that that is the year that whites will lose their majority in this country.
Blacks will outnumber whites. Latinos will outnumber blacks. Maybe our ideas about race and power will be bad dreams of the past.
The fiction, the romance, and the technicolor dreams. Black and white people.
Or maybe whites will go from being the majority with most of the power and preferences to the minority with all the same things. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, March 11th. We just heard Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center, clearly somebody who thinks a lot about race, trying to grapple with what it will mean when the majority in the United States is no longer the majority but the minority. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Well, I'm the minority in this discussion, that's for sure. And I'm down here live in South Florida at the studios of WLRN for one more day, talking about Haiti and all kinds of other issues. Let's get a check of the morning's top news stories. We're getting some preliminary results now from Iraq's election. Early on, our partner, the New York Times, says Prime Minister Maliki's coalition is likely to win the most votes. But it's extremely close right now. If these results hold, Maliki will have to knit together enough seats in the new parliament to elect a prime minister. Here at home, our partner, the New York Times, says sweeping new proposals may transform American education. Yesterday, governors and school chiefs around the country released a blueprint for K through 12th grade instruction, calling on states to teach specific topics in each grade level, replacing present guidelines, which vary wildly from state to state. Dane Lynn with the National Governors Association talks to NBC News.
We can't wait any longer to close the achievement gap. If we don't get more students, and particularly students of color and from low-income families, into college, the U.S. economy is not going to survive.
The White House supports this plan and promises federal money to states who adopt it.
President Obama can see the finish line in the year-long battle to reform health care.
It's time for an up or down vote in Washington on health care reform. Tired of talking about it, let's get it done.
Speaking in St. Louis yesterday, the president said he'll show the final details of the bill to Democrats at a meeting later today. And as we referred to earlier, new projections this week say this could be the year that the number of babies born to minorities in America outnumbers babies born to whites. We're going to be talking about that this morning and what it means about our ideas of race in America. But we're joined now by Maria Hinojosa. She's host and managing editor of Latino USA. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning.
So we actually have already seen this happen, at least in states like California. Do we know what kind of impact we're seeing, say, in California, where whites are already in the minority?
Well, essentially what it's done, Celeste, is it's turned our image of our country upside down. For young people, what it's done is it's opened their eyes to see that there's no difference between them and any other quote-unquote minority. But for others, it has completely blinded them and set them up with an image of fear of what happens in the future. But essentially, I haven't used the term minority for decades. Well, it looks like that's the way it's going to be for the rest of the country.
Okay, stay with us. Maria Hinojosa will be back with you in just a moment. But we do want to get this conversation started with our listeners. How do these labels, minority and majority, fit in your life?
If whites are outnumbered by blacks and Hispanics, then of course they'll be the new minority. Big deal.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website. Maybe it is no big deal. Our website is thetakeaway.org. Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are up, European indices are down, futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,567, the S&P at 1,145, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,358. Later this hour, we're also going to get the scoop about the upcoming South by Southwest Festival and what technological innovations could be released there. But our conversation about the changing definition of minority is coming up. I America is becoming more diverse. That is not news. But what is news is this new demographic study that shows kids are leading the way. Just under half of the children in America, less than 5 years old, are non-white. But some demographers say 2010 could be the tipping point when there will be more babies of color than white babies born in the United States. So is minority even a relevant term anymore? We're joined now by Kenneth Johnson. He's a professor of sociology and senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute, and he co-authored the report that was released yesterday on the growing diversity of America's young people. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning.
So can you kind of sum up what are the main findings of this report were?
Well, the main findings were, as you reported, that 48% of the children born last year in the United States were members of minorities, by which we mean they were not non-Hispanic white. And the structuring of the United States' population tends to be going from youngest to oldest, so that among those 1 to 4, about 46% are minority. But among those over the age of 20, it's 31% who are minorities. And we also looked at the geographic spread of this phenomenon, and we already have 500 counties in the United States where most of the children are members of groups other than the non-Hispanic white part of the population. Another 300 are close to being in that position, and in contrast, there are only 300 counties in total in which the minority populations represent the majority of everyone in the county.
Okay, so Kenneth Johns, that's a lot of numbers. I think I've taken them all in, but does this mean that within 20 years, the adult population, whites will no longer be the majority?
Well, the population projections by the Census Bureau are that somewhere around the middle of the century, there's a lot of disagreement exactly when, but around 2050 or so, the majority of the American population will not be non-Hispanic white.
What's the gap there? If we're going to tip the point on babies this year, possibly, then why would there be 40 years before that would affect the adult population?
Well, it takes a long time for the population to change. As I said, only 31% of the adult population is in a minority group. So that all that young population has to flow up through the whole age structure before it would transition the whole age structure. Plus, it's unclear what are going to happen to immigration levels. Immigration is down a little bit now because of the recession. We don't know how many children everyone is going to have. Hispanic women tend to have about one more child than non-Hispanic white women, but traditionally immigrant groups have eventually had their birth rate slow down. We don't know how that's going to happen among Hispanics. So, I mean, there are still a lot of unknowns about exactly when this is going to happen.
You know, but I got to ask you, Kenneth Johnson, I was reading this report and there's a lot of places in which you've talked about the minority majority and the majority minority, which is incredibly confusing. Are you going to have to find a new vocabulary for talking about this, or are you planning to still use these words majority and minority?
Well, honestly, my focus is always on the numbers and the data. I admit that some of these terms are a little complicated to deal with, and I would be happy to have somebody create new ones, but I'm a demographer. I'm used to dealing with, if you think majority-minority is a tough one to deal with, you should see some of the other stuff we struggle with. So.
Okay, well, Kenneth Johnson is a professor of sociology and a senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute. Let's go back to Maria Hinojosa. She's host and managing editor of NPR's Latino USA, also an Emmy Award-winning reporter with Now on PBS. Good morning again, Maria.
Good morning, or probably I should say buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
There
well,
you go.
You know, you heard Kenneth struggling over the terms to use. Are we going to have to find a place, something to replace minority?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the interesting thing, Celeste, is that a long time ago, I would probably say early 1990s, I decided that I was no longer going to use that term, minority. It went out of my vocabulary. I have two kids, a 14-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl. They have never heard me use the term, well, we're a member of a minority group, or yeah, you're a minority. Never.
A majority lost its meaning for me living in Brooklyn, I think, years ago. And I have five kids. The irony here is I have five kids. You have two, right, Maria?
Yeah, John. Well, you know, obviously you were busier than I was, but hey, you know.
But I actually delivered my 8-year-old to a birthday party this week, and it's not the first time where she was the only white girl at the party.
Yeah, and so here's what's fascinating. I mean, this change opens up all kinds of, like, wonderful possibilities. I was walking through a park near my home in Harlem, and I was with my daughter, and in front of me there was clearly a Latina babysitter, nanny, with two little white girls. And as we approached them, the Latina nanny was speaking to the little girls in Spanish. And the little girls were answering her in English. And I was like, wow, that is so cool. You have a mom who made a decision to hire a Latina nanny and tell her, I want you to speak Spanish to my kids. And they're open to it. On the other hand, there's the whole element of fear. And oh my God, if whites are a minority, we know how minorities are treated in this country. It doesn't look so good for them.
Well, let me ask you that question, and let me go back to the question I posed at the top of the show, Maria. As whites become the minority, does that mean there'll be an automatic shifting of power, that the preferences that we're seeing that will move?
Well, I think that what we have to recognize is that this is going to be a power struggle, and that's what makes it kind of hard and ugly in some places. But, you know, what's joyful about it is that, on the one hand, you can have Dora the Explorer, which, of course, Huckenberry's kids have seen. All of them have seen Dora the Explorer, like mine. They grew up looking at this little brown-skinned bilingual girl, and the little girls are saying, I want to be like Dora. And the little boys are saying, yo quiero ser como Diego. So on the one hand, you have, and she's the largest selling children's character ever in history, billions, billions of dollars. So on the one hand, you've got that, which is really cool. On the other hand, you have, well, our friend Lou Dobbs, who was paid $8 million after he was fired, but he's still on the radio. And what he has done consistently is to paint an image of this Latino person. I mean, it's an undocumented immigrant who he's talking about. But basically, people just see Latinos now as a threat to everything that America stands for, our language, our culture, our demographics, our jobs. So you've got these two things happening at the same time. How it's going to play out, I think it plays out one-to-one. People talking to each other and, you know, getting over this question of fear.
Okay, Maria Hinojosa is the host and managing editor of NPR's Latino USA, obviously a subject that we could talk about for a very long time. So, Maria, I'm going to ask you our takeaway question today. We're asking our listeners how these labels fit in their lives. Do you consider yourself to be part of majority?
I'm a human being, I'm American, and I'm really hopeful about our future as people have lots of babies. I think that means hope.
Okay. You can give us your take at 8778MYTAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. And now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
The foreclosure crisis isn't over. It may be slowing down, though. RealtyTrack this morning says the number of households facing foreclosure in February grew 6% from a year ago. That's the smallest increase year to year in 4 years. But RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga says foreclosure levels still remain high.
The fact that we're looking at over 300,000 households getting a foreclosure notice as being something of a relief suggests that we're perhaps getting a little bit numb to the level of activity we're really looking at.
That level could increase again if households being considered for loan modifications don't receive them and people lose their homes. President Obama meets today with members of the Congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses to discuss his health care proposals. Democrats say they are getting close to a final vote on the bill.
The Senate has already passed a bill that provides $150 billion to be spent on reducing unemployment. The measure includes tax breaks for businesses that take on unemployed workers, and it now goes to the House for approval. Abroad, first results in Iraq's elections indicate Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's coalition is likely to win in a close race. There remains some allegations of vote rigging, however. And Chile's new president, Sebastián Piñera, will be sworn in later today. He ends 2 decades of left-wing dominance in Chile. And in Japan, dozens of merchants protested at Tokyo's fish market this morning against plans to ban the trade in bluefin tuna. Earlier, the European Union agreed to support an international ban. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up in the stories about race and minorities and majorities, we're going to be taking a look at the majorities in baseball with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts begin live from Miami. We're in South Florida in the studios of WLRN in Miami. We begin with the voice of Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor up there in New York. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Fellow Brooklynite.
Indeed.
I thought we'd continue that pretty fascinating discussion of race that ended there with Maria Hinojosa talking about how as the demographics shift, there's a tendency for some groups to maybe cling to power, and we certainly see that in our politics. In sports, this transition has happened really over many, many decades, right?
It's true. That's a good point.
I mean, African Americans are the majority in basketball, have been for a long time. It's odd to note that whites are still the majority in baseball.
It's very true. And actually, yesterday we heard some interesting points about this from Torrey Hunter, who's a center fielder for the Los Angeles Angels. Did you see that, John?
Yes, indeed.
So he said basically that people see dark faces out there, and the perception is that they're African Americans. And then he goes on to say, they're not us. They're imposters. And then he says, even people I know come up and say, hey, what color is Vladimir Guerrero? And he said, is he a black player? And he says, I say, come on, he's a Dominican. He's not black. And a lot of people don't understand, Hunter says, that the percentage of white players in the game is down too.
You know, he's making this really interesting nuanced point, which as this majority-minority thing shifts, also the differences between individual groups come out. I mean, I was born in the 50s, and as a little boy, it was just whites and then everybody else. That's no longer the case. And how are these comments going down, if Torrey Hunter?
Well, he's actually, what he's doing is he's opening up the vault of truth, in a sense. Ozzie Guillen, who's a manager for the White Sox, he acknowledged that it was a funny context, but he said that they look for places where they have talent. And that brings up this question. Is America's pastime reflective of America, or is it just the best baseball league in the world? And as sports fans...
Well, what do you think? What do you think?
And I think it's actually both. I think it is reflective of America within the percentages, and every generation does reflect somewhat of the American conversation and the American struggle that we're dealing with. But I think also it is the best baseball league in the world, and that's why you have players from all over the world that are clamoring to get here to play.
You know, and the other thing that's interesting, and this also is reflected in our politics in the United States racially, and that there's a labor issue involved there. Who gets the jobs? And part of what Torrey is talking about there is that, Latino, particularly people from the Dominican Republic, et cetera, there's a wide perception they're given a preference into the major leagues because of all kinds of favorable issues, talent only being one of them.
Well, listen, CC Sabathia and I spoke about this right after the Yankees won the World Series. And one of his main points was that in America, the African-American players, they're growing up in places that don't have the space and the facilities to play baseball the way that they used to in the past. And one of the big reasons why young athletes, African-American athletes, are going into football and basketball is because there's full scholarships connected to that. If American baseball and colleges gave out full scholarships, you would see more athletes from African-American athletes playing baseball. But at this point, if you're growing up and you have a choice of going a track of getting full scholarship to school or going a full track of going to play in the minor leagues for the next 8 years, you don't even know when you're going to get to the majors, I'd go for the full scholarship.
Huh. If you were coming out of college now and had multiple opportunities, what sport would you pick, Ibrahim?
The funny thing is,
you had an opportunity, maybe football, right?
Yeah, no, I did. I think baseball is the best sport to play for the longer term, and you'll sign your big contract when you're 28, 29, 30. So honestly, I think it's funny considering all this. I would probably play baseball.
All right, what position?
I'd definitely be an outfielder, and then I would be one of the 8% compared to the 28% of foreign players. So I'm African-American. I'd be one of 8% players in Major League Baseball.
The demographics of baseball from our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Thanks for that.
For our last take, we look to our listeners, and their responses are...
Genius.
Of course, we're in the middle of a week-long series about genius, who is one, whether that's a blessing or a curse, how it carries pitfalls. We got this interesting take from Liz. She writes us, even in kindergarten, my son was labeled a genius. Today, he's an interventional cardiologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. The problem? He has two sisters who, for all of their lives, measured themselves against him and felt they came up short. Now, in the real world, these two young women are way smarter than their brother. They're what would be called street smart. So who's really the genius here? If you want to catch up on this series and share your own take, go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
And we're going to continue that conversation later on in the morning. Failure as a pathway to genius. There are a lot of great conversations to be a part of on thetakeaway.org. We talked yesterday about how the economy is delaying people's retirement plans, and that prompted a lot of stories.
My name is Terry Arnold, and yes, my retirement plan has changed. My retirement plan was at Harrison's, and my dad has lost it all. So I'll be working until I'm dead. Thank you.
This is Jack. I retired in 1994 at the age of 39 to Montana. Spent 5 wonderful years there, moved to Florida, where I was accidentally hired and continued working since. Tell you the truth, this latest recession has not affected me whatsoever or my latest plans to retire.
Lucky Jack, and poor Terry there. Gives new meaning to the term exit interview, hey? But and you can see this on our site, too. We've had a lot of people saying, are you kidding me? When our guest yesterday, Duke University economics professor Mike Munger, had this advice.
What is your income? Multiply that by 16. That's how much you need. So if you're making $50,000 a year, you need to have saved $800,000.
$800,000? Why did I think of that? $800,000. This is Greg from Boston. I got to get to work.
You can actually see Mike Munger's response to our listeners on our site, thetakeaway.org, because he's posting his comments just like you are. Remember, folks, 800K. Remember.
Finally, we told you the story of Illinois' Democratic Party opening up the nomination for lieutenant governor to everyone. We thought, hey, how would you campaign in your own state?
Hi, this is Scott from South Carolina, and I absolutely could be lieutenant governor of the state of South Carolina for two primary reasons. First and foremost, I have a passport and can travel to Argentina. Secondly, I have never been on the Appalachian Trail.
Bazing! Keep the conversations going. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, Joe Biden wrapped up a trip to Israel this morning with a speech in Tel Aviv. We'll detect a pulse in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process with a full analysis of the vice president's trip in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Preliminary results from Iraq's election. Our partner, the New York Times, says early on, Prime Minister Maliki's coalition, the main Shiite coalition, is likely to win the most votes, but it's extremely close. A Sunni coalition is running a close second. But a separate group is challenging the entire vote counting process. A plan that could transform American education. That's what our partner, the New York Times, is calling a proposal by governors and education officials for nationwide standards in our schools. It calls on states to teach specific topics in each grade level. Chester Finn of the Fordham Institute tells NBC News.
It's revolutionary if we not just agree on what they should learn, but then actually take the heavy lifts that are necessary to get them to learn those things.
An example is by seventh grade. Under the proposal, all kids will need to have basic geometry and algebra skills. The White House promises federal money to states who adopt this plan.
Trying to regain the reform mantra, House Democrats have banned corporate earmarks. The idea is to make members of Congress give up their long-cherished practice of directing federal dollars to their home districts. Republicans countered by calling for a ban on all earmarks. The House also wants to ban misleading mailings that look like they're from the Census Bureau. This comes after some Republican groups have been sending out fundraising letters labeled census document. The mailings asked for money and for voters to reveal their political stance. Overseas this morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iranian support for the Taliban in Afghanistan isn't much of a problem for the U.S. right now. Gates says as far as the U.S. can tell, Iran's support for the insurgency is, quote, pretty limited. And checking in on the markets, Asian markets are up, European indices are down, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,567. The S&P opens at 1,145 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,358. Those are some of the news stories you're watching this morning.
So it was a tall order, even when Vice President Joe Biden landed in Israel earlier this week to begin the highest level visit yet by a member of the Obama administration. But things got tense once he was there because of a particularly ill-timed decision by the Israeli government to suddenly announce new settlement building in East Jerusalem. That created some complications. And this morning, the vice president gave a speech in Tel Aviv and attempted to ease some of those tensions.
Well, it's always easier to point fingers. It's time for Israelis and Palestinian leaders to acknowledge each other's steps to heed this call, even when more remains to be done. And for the world to do the same thing.
Getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to acknowledge the positives in the stalled peace process is a challenge all by itself. Even finding those positives is maybe a greater challenge. To take a look at this speech and the meaning of this visit of the vice president for the Middle East and for the larger Obama administration policy, we spoke with Aaron David Miller, former Middle East negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's also a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. But we began by talking with Heather Sharp, BBC reporter in Jerusalem, who joined us once again. And I asked Heather if Biden's speech meant that the Obama administration was now satisfied with the Israeli prime minister's response to that ill-timed settlement announcement.
I think perhaps there is a message from the Americans that they're in some sense satisfied with what the Israelis have been saying this morning. This morning, the office of Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement saying the prime minister regretted the timing of the decision and that he'd called in the interior minister to essentially give him a dressing down over the timing. And Mr. Biden said he appreciated that. And he also said he was reassured that construction on these very, very controversial homes in East Jerusalem was not going to start possibly for quite a few years. So his words were conciliatory towards Israel. But at the same time, the actual sense of what's going to happen with the indirect talks that Mr. Biden came to launch is very, very much in question.
In fact, it's off in the fringes at this point. Heather Sharp, a BBC reporter. Aaron David Miller. Heather was speaking to us earlier this week and gave in her analysis a sense that as time has gone on in the administration, the significant challenges that existed when Barack Obama was inaugurated have been compounded by a real sense of growing bad faith between Palestinian negotiators and the Netanyahu administration there in Jerusalem. Would you agree with that?
Well, the situation isn't getting any better, put it that way. But the reality is Israeli settlement activity in East Jerusalem are not. The fundamental obstacles that now separate Israelis and Palestinians on the core issues, which after all is supposedly the focus of the entire exercise, getting an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, those basic issues, the parties really are separated on all of those issues by very large gaps. And until Israelis and Palestinians are willing and able to pay the price that is required to negotiate an agreement, we're simply not going to have one. So I think the vice president he's not a Middle East envoy. He didn't come to negotiate. Paradoxically, I think he came to provide a certain measure of coordination and reassurance to the Israelis on Iran, got caught up in the inevitable tick-tock of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
So, Aaron David Miller, and then to you, Heather Sharp, BBC reporter in Jerusalem, what would we call this visit? Biden biding time? Aaron David Miller?
You know, I think the vice president, he's a very smart guy, was reminded this week of the painful obvious, the painfully very obvious that, you know, in life sometimes no good deed goes unpunished. And basically, that's going to be the message of any Obama administration effort to mediate a conflict between two leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, who are not masters of their politics, but prisoners of their constituencies. And until you have the kind of leadership, again, willing and able to pay the price, there are going to be a lot more Biden-like visits.
As we've seen many times in the past, Heather Sharp, a BBC reporter, that a period like this of sort of lateral non-movement in the peace process can be accompanied by real serious demoralization on the street, both in terms of the Arab world, the Palestinian world, and among Israelis. How are people feeling at the conclusion of this visit?
Well, I think there was a sense of that in the way that Biden chose to address the people today in Tel Aviv, the students. He said, only a friend can deliver the harsh truth. This is no way to live. The status quo is unsustainable. And I think on the street, there was never any great expectation from this visit. I think the bad faith has, in a sense, percolated down to the people on the street. The Palestinians are increasingly frustrated when they continue to see building going on, even though there's supposed to be a freeze in the West Bank. They see the building going on in East Jerusalem. They see new things being announced. Deep frustration. There's been frustration over the announcement of the Israelis recently that they were going to put two controversial sites in the West Bank on the Israeli heritage list. And we have seen a bit of a stepping up in protest, in stone throwing. Hmm. And I think on the Israeli side, there's a constant sense of, well, what are the Palestinian leaders playing at? Do they or don't they want to negotiate with us? You know, where do we go from here?
Indeed. Heather Sharp, BBC reporter, reporting from Jerusalem. Finally, Aaron David Miller, former Middle East negotiator for both Republican and Democratic administrations. The Bush 2 administration was criticized for putting the Arab-Israeli peace process on the fringe tacitly for whatever reason. Has the Obama administration kind of done that at this point?
You know, governing is about choosing. You've got an overextended, overstretched president who's shepherding through his premier signature issue, health care, presiding over a jobless recovery and two ongoing costly and very unpopular wars. So, yeah, the Arab-Israeli conflict is important, but it's certainly not the most critical issue for the Obama administration.
Middle East analyst there, Aaron David Miller, also a negotiator for Republican and Democratic presidents, spoke with us from his home in Washington, D.C., where he's working on a new book, Can America have another great president? That's a good takeaway question for one of these days, that's for sure.
Actually, it
coming
is.
Up. Yeah, indeed. Coming up, some of you might know the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. Are you going this year?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I have the vacation time.
All right. Well, it's a music festival, of course, but Twitter got its big break at the South by Southwest, and we're going to find out what the tech is at the festival later this hour.
And something that you can weigh in on, especially there at WLRN in Miami, John, is we're asking, what does Haiti need from the world right now? Lots of opinions. What do you think? Get us know at 8778, my take. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, when he won the presidency in Chile last year, Sebastian Piñera didn't know he was inheriting a problem of disaster relief. Piñera will be sworn in later today, just 2 weeks after a massive earthquake hit the central part of the country. So he may have to throw out his entire agenda and focus solely on rebuilding. Joining us now is Gideon Long. He's the Chile correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joins us from Santiago. Hi, Gideon.
Hi there.
So tell me a little bit about this new president and what he ran on.
Well, Sebastian Piñera is a 60-year-old businessman, a billionaire, the third richest man in Chile, and one of the 1,000 richest men richest people in the world, according to Forbes. He made his money principally by introducing credit cards to Chile in the 1970s and 1980s, and then he made some very shrewd acquisitions of shares, particularly in the national airline LAN. That's how he's built up his fortune. He then went into politics. He's been in politics for quite some time, and he comes from a political family. His brother was a former minister in the military government of General Augusto Pinochet in the 1980s. He's moved into politics himself. This is his second bid for the presidency. He ran against Michelle Bachelet back in 2005 and lost. He ran again last year and in January this year against Eduardo Frei, and he's won. So he's been angling for the presidency for quite some time, and he's finally achieved it.
Well, he is going to be a conservative turn for Michelle Bachelet, correct?
That's right, and it's interesting. This is the first time that a conservative-led government has been back in power since General Pinochet stepped down 20 years ago. So it really does feel like the end of an era, the end of 20 consecutive years of centre-left rule. And it's the first time the conservatives have gained power via the ballot box since 1958. So it certainly feels very symbolic.
What were his campaign promises?
Well, he campaigned on the economy. He's a businessman, so that's obviously his specialist area. He's promised Chileans 6% annual growth over the next 4 years, and he's promised to create 1 million new jobs, which is quite a claim, given that the workforce in Chile is less than 8 million people. So far, he said that despite the quake, he's sticking to those pledges. His other main campaign issue was crime, which has been increasing in Chile and has been an increasing concern, particularly to people in Santiago. So he campaigned on a tough law and order ticket. Again, he said he's going to stick to those pledges during his presidency, despite the earthquake.
Has he said? I mean, we heard a lot of stories about violence and looting after the earthquake. We also know that it's going to cost a lot of money for Chile to recover from the earthquake. Has he said how he's going to bring about growth, jobs, and less crime after the earthquake?
He hasn't. He's been very short on details so far, but we're expecting that once he assumes power later today. He's holding a press conference tomorrow, and I suspect that some more details might come out as to how exactly his plans will change. But he has said that, for 2 years, he and his advisors have been working up their ideas, and they've just had to rip up the book and start again because of the earthquake. It's going to be a massive reconstruction effort. Having said that, I don't think it's necessarily all negative for Mr. Piñera. In some ways, this falls into his hands. He's taking power amid a scene of incredible solidarity between Chileans, as we've seen before with 9/11 in the States and with other disasters around the world. It tends to bring people together. So in some ways, he's starting with a tremendous amount of goodwill.
Gideon Long is the correspondent in Chile for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much, Gideon. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I am joined by John Hockenberry all the way from Miami, Florida. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
We're
loving it down here.
A lot of acts play the South by Southwest Festival. Maybe you've heard of some of them. Maybe you've heard of a little act named Twitter out of New York. right.
I have all their albums.
South by Southwest, not just about music and film, but also about technology. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But first, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In the past few minutes, we've gotten fresh economic news. New unemployment claims fell last week. The AP says that's a sign the job market is slowly improving. Democratic leaders say they're close to getting a health care bill, but they still need a full cost analysis from the Congressional Budget Office. President Obama meets today with members of the Congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses to talk about his health care plans. And Toyota's recalls are bringing new scrutiny to the government's auto safety agency. Congress is taking a look today at how federal safety officials have lived up to their task of protecting motorists. The Red Cross says nearly a quarter of Zimbabwe's population is in need of food aid. It's pleading for international donations. And in Greece, protesters have clashed with riot police. The violence came as workers nationwide are on strike again to protest budget-cutting measures from the government.
The U.S. Postal Regulatory Commission, which regulates the post office, says customers need more advance notice of cuts or changes in the service. The post office recently proposed cutting Saturday mail delivery in an effort to tackle its budget deficit. The Forbes Rich List is out. For the first time in 16 years, an American has failed to take the number one spot. Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim is now the world's richest man, according to Forbes. He made his billions with those cash for cell phone time cards and his cell phone businesses. He has $53.5 billion, according to Forbes. There's some politicians on the list. The new president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, is going to be sworn in today. He's taking a page, in a sense, from Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who's also on the list. Bloomberg came to power right after 9/11, but Piñera comes to power right after that earthquake in Chile. But the big story out of the Forbes list is that China now has 64 billionaires, putting it second place, right behind the U.S. Earlier, we spoke with the BBC's Michael Bristow, who joined us from Beijing. Who are all these new additions to the super rich in China?
Well, a large section of these people are involved in property. If you can just imagine, China over the last 30 years or so has been completely rebuilding. I've got so used to seeing cranes all over the place that it's become second nature just to see them, and I expect them everywhere I see. So obviously that's made a lot of people very rich, and about a third to a quarter of people, Chinese billionaires, are involved in that sector. But there are also other people from manufacturing. There are people like and processing, people like China's richest person, according to Forbes. That's Zhong Qingho. Now, he runs a multi-billion dollar company that makes soft drinks, and there's also someone called Li Shufu, and he runs a car company called Geely. He started off life as the son of a farmer and worked his way up, and that company is now poised to buy Sweden's Volvo cars. So you can see that there's not just in property, there's a big range of people who make up China's billionaires, many of them joining this list for the first time.
You know, the United States is fond of its own kind of rags-to-riches stories in talking about a rise from obscurity. Is there a narrative in China that some of these billionaires have in common? I mean, do they end up hoarding their money? Do they become philanthropists? Do they enter politics? Do they become global figures?
Well, they do enter politics, some of them, because the communist parties try to co-opt many businessmen into the system. But most don't. Most get involved in just making money. And there is a lot of rags-to-riches story. It's interesting that many of the people who are Chinese billionaires, they've started with nothing, worked their way up, and now have reached the top. Really, it's a capitalist dream here in China.
All right. Talking about the capitalist dream, Michael Bristow, economics reporter for our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Common fears start to
multiply. Song Vaporized by Broken Bells. They're playing at this year's South by Southwest Festival in Austin, and that's what most people know South by Southwest for music and for film as well. But it's also one of the most creative tech conferences in the United States. Here to talk about that is our Takeaway Tech contributor, host of Popular Science's Future of, Baratunde Thurston. He joins us from the airport. Actually, Baratunde, you're about to catch a flight to Austin for the festival, right?
Yes, I am. I'm on a JetBlue flight, and they were nice enough to find me a relatively quiet spot in the airport. So good to be here, and good to be back. Thanks.
So tell me about the South by Southwest Festival. What kind of technological innovations have come out of this festival?
Well, I think the first thing people need to understand is that, you know, because this festival happens in the context of the better-known Film and Music Fest, South by Southwest Interactive, which is what the tech component is called, it's just more creative. You have web designers, you have software developers, you have just a few business people relative to the overall audience, and not so much in the terms of hardware like you'd find at the Consumer Electronics Show. So it's just a different, sort of more, slightly more artistic and creative state of mind. So one of the services that really blew up at South by a few years ago, and people who go call it South by because it's not short enough to say South by Southwest, is Twitter. You know, Twitter was developed not there, didn't launch there, but it certainly made its first mark there. And you get a lot of these, you know, digital, you know, digerati type people come to Austin, Texas, this hub of activity and culture, and then fling back out across the world and take what they've learned back to their businesses, to their campuses, to their organizations, and sometimes to their homes.
So, I mean, the South by Southwest, as you're describing, is a more kind of technological, maybe philosophical, creative sort of platform. What kind of things will be coming out this year? If it's not hardware and not technically software, what is it?
Well, one of the big battles now that so many people have smart mobile phones, and it's still not the majority, but it's growing. It's one of the few growing areas in electronics. Location is a big deal. As I like to say, location is communication. So the ability to share your location with trusted parties, with your family, with your friends, in a slightly more passive way than calling them or explicitly texting them, I'm over here. You know, we often wonder how we were ever able to coordinate meeting folks before cell phones came along, because we couldn't call and say, no, I'm to the left, I'm to the right, you know, two blocks north. Well, imagine something even more efficient than that, where you simply, you know, whip out your phone, ping, I'm right here, and it knows the venue you're at, it knows how many other people who are your friends are nearby. So two companies, one called Foursquare, which is based in New York, and one called Gowalla, based in Austin, are going to kind of be battling it out for supremacy in this location space.
Also sounds like a really good way to locate your child if they get lost at Disneyland. But, you know, let me ask you about what you'll be talking about at the festival. You have a talk coming up that's called How to Be Black. Does it seem like people need to instructions how to do that, Baratunde?
Yeah, everybody wants to be it, but nobody really wants to be it. I'm happy to be a part of a series called Future 15, and they're attempting to bring, you know, some diverse perspectives to the area of technology. So the title is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'm going to be talking about black people on the internet and on the social web especially. You know, you don't hear often in the press examples of who's using Facebook or how is MySpace still relevant, where's SMS going and text messaging, and who's using Twitter. And one of the interesting things I note is that of the trending topics on a service like Twitter, so many of them come right out of, you know, current black culture and are driven by black users on Twitter. Sort of a big secret that Twitter is possibly very disproportionately African-American versus the perception that people have. So I'll be making some fun observations like that, getting into a little bit of statistics, and of course having a laugh or two.
So maybe whites are the minority among Twitter users, which brings us to our takeaway question, Baratunde.
Yeah.
Thurston, we're asking people today, as the demographics change, I'm wondering, let me ask you the same question we're asking listeners. How, in what ways are you a minority, and what ways do you think of yourself as a majority?
Well, you know, I had an encounter with someone on the street earlier, and she didn't even have Google Maps on her phone, and I realized that, you know, everyone in this space going to South by Southwest Interactive is a minority relative to certainly global society and even the average American citizen. So it's worth it for all of us to keep that in mind as we get these pie-in-the-sky visions of this great future, that we have to make sure to share, you know, all that efficiency and all that wealth with the rest of our folks.
Technology nerds a minority, I guess so. Thank you, Baratunde Thurston, Takeaway Tech Contributor. He's on his way to the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas.
No Google Maps on the phone? That
oh
is
my,
so
shocking.
Totally white. That is so white, man. I'm in Miami. Here's something you can weigh in while I'm with our friends at WLRN in South Florida. We're asking the question to a very outspoken group of listeners here, but it's for all of you listening to The Takeaway. What does Haiti need from the world right now? If you've been affected by the quake, especially if you're Haitian, what are you not getting that you still need? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org.
And we're also talking about the changing definition of minority and majority in America, and we're asking you, how do these labels fit in with your life?
My name is Maureen, and I'm currently driving through Groton, Massachusetts. What we need to focus on is financial. In other words, if the Black and Latino and Asian communities continue or remain minorities, then we'll run into problems if they're financial minorities.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Already a lively conversation on our website. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.